I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, we're back. We're still on our break.
I know. It's still a short break.
I hope you guys are enjoying our break, too.
And we never made it to the beach.
No.
Well, I did. I made it to the L.A. beaches.
But... Yeah. You go to the beach quite a lot. But it's not with like an umbrella and a drink.
We're not throwing frisbee out there, are we?
No, we're not. Okay, so this is the second week of our break. We're leading you into our 15th season next week.
Mm-hmm. People really liked our little suggestions, I think, from last week.
So. I think so, too. Uh-huh. Right?
Let's try it again.
So we're going to bring you this week Kiese Layman.
Kiese.
We love, we're telling you how it reminded us of a episode from last season, from season 14.
Right.
And so go with me with this, hon. I thought that Kiese's episode reminded me of Dr. Willie Parker.
Oh, I can see that.
Right?
Tell me what made you think about that.
Well, okay, so they're both black men from the South.
Mm-hmm.
Very strong.
Yep.
You know, well-respected.
Well-spoken.
Well-spoken. Kiese is from Mississippi. Dr. Willie Parker is from different southern states.
But in the same region.
And so when we were talking to Dr. Parker, I often thought about Kiese, and I think that people will enjoy his episode in the same way. And the commentary on today's society feels very similar to me.
Yeah, it's a great perspective. Good choice, hon.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Lelia Gowland's On My Nightstand episode. I read her essay, I'm Coming Out.
Oh, yeah. That was really, really popular. People really enjoyed that.
Right? They mm-hmm. loved it. And it reminded me of Bad Kid by David Crabb.
Oh, which, David, yeah.
Right?
That makes sense.
That's another one I read last season.
Mm-hmm.
And why does it make sense to you?
They remind me maybe because they're both coming out and announcing yes. to the world something very intimate and personal about themselves.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I mean, I think Bad Kid is all about, like, the whole book is about David Crabb's kind of coming to terms with who he is and then letting the people in around him about mm-hmm. who he is,
absolutely.
Right? Letting them into it. And then Lelia's essay is specifically about coming out.
Oh, and so well spoken, Lelia. So if yes. you missed that, jump back and listen to that one if you can. And
100%.
Hit David Crabb.
Yep.
He's the Bad Kid.
And the last one we're going to bring you for the break, right before season 15, like I said, is Andrea Owen. She was the only one telling women to make some noise. And I thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was like Amy Green Smith, who was the only one telling people how to speak up for themselves without being a dick.
I love that. Yeah.
Right.
Totally different perspectives and same message, huh?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they're friends that we actually found Amy through Andrea.
Ah, that makes total sense.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three episodes that you're going to check for this break. And then stay tuned next week for
season 15, y'all.
Drum roll.
Yeah, we have a great season coming up. We hope you guys are ready for it.
Yeah, we're really excited. Some good stories.
Nice job, honey.
Thanks, hon.
I'm Kiese Lehman. And I am the only Black Southern writer in the room. I've seen what I think white supremacy in Mississippi and New York and in the nation can do to our bodies just in terms of shrinkage or sometimes making yourself seem like you're so like a giant because you're scared of what these people will do. And I just didn't want to do either of those things. Like, I don't need to let people know how many degrees I have or talk down to anybody, white person who's serving me. And I definitely don't need to make myself small or act like I'm the biggest patriot in the world to have a critique of this country. My challenge is to not.
Picture this. You have a book to write, a memoir which contains so much raw truth that you'd rather write a lie instead. Writer, author, and professor Kiese Lehman wrote about the weight of racism, the weight of obesity, and the weight of sex, gambling, and familial love, and addressed the whole thing to his mother. But what would you do if publishing your book would mean naming all the secrets you'd spent a lifetime avoiding? Would you put your life on blast and let the whole world in? Or would you take the easier, softer way and write a lie that you could live with? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl, and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Kiese Lehman, how are you?
I'm happy to be talking to you. Thank you for wanting to talk to me.
Wow. You're not as happy as I am to be talking to you. I can just tell you that. I wanted to ask you, is there a song that always brings you out onto the dance floor?
Wow. I'm embarrassed. The answer would be yes.
What is it?
Okay. So I only like the beginning of this song.
Uh-huh.
This is a song by Mystical called A Man Right Here.
Uh-huh.
And the first 30, 40 seconds of that song are just epic. They just make you feel like you won an award, even if you never even tried. You
really?
Know what I mean? Like, I always imagine walking. It was like, I always imagine walking. When that first song first came out, I always imagine walking slow-mo up to some podium to
right.
get something. You know what I'm saying?
That's yeah. your award-winning music there.
I never said that out loud, but the song, but the lyrics of the song, you know, I don't condone, I'm not down with them, but the first 30 seconds, ooh,
yeah,
epic.
Okay, all right, that I'll should, have to that, check it out.
That should be my alarm when I wake up in the morning. Like, yeah. I feel like I won yes. an award it'll, every it'll, day.
Yeah, just start walking slow-mo to get your coffee.
Right?
I love it.
All right, thank you for that. I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. But I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey.
Hey.
So today we are talking to Kiese Lehman. And Kiese is a Black Southern writer From Jackson, Mississippi, Lehman's best-selling memoir, Heavy, an American memoir, which won so many awards, was named in the 50 best memoirs of the past 50 years by the New York Times, which just blew me away. Chiesa is also a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Oxford American. He has written for New York Times, Esquire, VSB, ESPN, The Magazine, Paris Review, NPR, Color Lines, The Los Angeles Times, The Guardian, Ebony, Guernica, Theta.
Take a breath, honey.
Travel and Leisure, and so many others. And other books by Chiesa include How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America and Long Division. So welcome, Chiesa. We're so excited to have you here.
Welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank y'all.
So the first question I usually start everybody off with is, how do you identify?
I think I identify as a Black Southern writer.
Mm-hmm.
If I go deeper than that, I still sort of identify as a Black boy, even though I'm a 46-year-old man.
Okay.
And I'm a Mississippian.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I gleaned all of that from your writing, and I understand why you identify as a Black boy, especially because so much happened to you growing up that it's just such a rich piece of your history, right? And I identify as a girl still in my head.
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Good.
I definitely do. I just want to talk about Heavy for a minute. I was just stunned by it, and I devoured it. I was on a 3-day vacation, and I just want to start by saying, and I think I wrote this to you in the email, that I've had a really hard time reading since the pandemic started. And it's just really hard for me to focus on something for that long. And I do it, and because I read all the books, you know, that our guests write. And I do read, but it's hard for me, and I have to force myself to finish things, to complete things. And I brought your book with me on vacation, and I mean, it was gone in 3 days. It was like this really, really good meal, which is kind of ironic. And I wanted to savor it and make it last longer, but I also needed to finish it because I needed to know how it ended. The whole time I was ignoring Scott because I couldn't wait to disappear back into its pages. And I recommended it to everybody. And like we talked about, Melba and Ralph Farquhar, Melba was the one who was like, you've got to have him on your show. So shout out to her.
And big shout out.
Yeah. And Clint Schaff, do you know him from LA Times Studios?
No, I don't.
Well, he knows you. After I posted about the book, he started directing me to more of your writings and to the letters from your mom. And he also said he would be an amazing guest on The Only One in the Room. So
I'm so thankful to those folks.
Yeah. So I just want to talk about one of your first scenes in the book. You're a kid, and an older girl who you seem to be a little in awe of has agreed to let some big boys run a train on her, which is have sex with her one at a time, in exchange for permission to swim in the deep end of the swimming pool that exists in that house. And after they're done with her, one of the boys offers her up to you, saying, take your big football playing ass in there and get you some if you want. And instead, you offer her something to drink or eat, head to the kitchen to get some supplies. And then on page 19, you write, I opened a bottle of thick blue cheese dressing and drank as much as I could. And as soon as I read that, Chiesa, I was like, oh, okay. I understand that. I know what this is now.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Wow. You know, nobody's ever asked me about that detail, but...
Really?
No, strange, because remembering that and writing that sort of captivated my body. I mean, again, this house was, I always talk about this house as like the internet before the internet. You know what I'm saying? They had cable. They had the best speakers. They had new encyclopedias, right? Because the internet didn't exist.
I remember.
Cabinets filled with fucking like Tang and like on brand Pop-Tarts and Fruit Loops and... And so my friends were there, but I also just liked to go there because they had what we didn't have in my house, which was like food. You know, my mother, for different reasons, we just didn't have much food at the house. And after seeing after hearing what happened to my friend, who I definitely had a big crush on, and I think it's okay to say what happened was rape and sexual assault. I just wanted to be satiated. So, you know, I wanted to drink Tang. I wanted to drink blue cheese dressing for some reason. It doesn't make sense other than I mean, but I think that sets the trajectory of the book.
Yes.
But I can remember it, like, you know, and it was glass because they didn't have like the plastic squeezing ones, you know,
right.
Like just a sort of like a, almost like a mason jar sort of look like a blue cheese dressing. And somehow I just thought like the thickness of it could make me escape somehow. I just wanted to escape into that bottle. So I tried to drink it. You know, yeah. I don't want to psychoanalyze myself too much, but that detail and blue cheese dressing to this day just remind me of those sort of 20 minutes of my life where I was terrified and complicit.
Yeah. Wow. And that thing of needing something on the outside to fill a hole on the inside, right? I can take this substance in my body and change the way I feel. That's what I understood then. I mean, I've never drank blue cheese dressing, but I could completely understand why you needed to down that bottle of it before you went back upstairs with the on-brand Pop-Tart. I love that.
Right.
Because so many of them were off-brand.
Yeah.
At the time.
Definitely.
Oh, I hated those too. And they didn't have the icing
toaster
either.
Treats.
Yes.
No, they definitely. And if they did have icing, it's interesting. It's like the icing would be right in the middle.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the icing didn't reach
the ends. They skimped on the icing.
They definitely skimped. Most definitely skimped.
I was so struck by that scene. And in fact, I have a little group of women that includes my mother that I walk with on Saturday. Four black women. We call it our Black Girl Magic Dog Walk. And three of us are in recovery, and not my mom. But as soon as I couldn't wait to tell them about your book, because I was like, there's this scene, this scene right at the beginning where he drinks a bottle of blue cheese dressing to go up and face something that he's afraid of. And they all nodded, and then they all went online and bought the book.
Wow.
Yeah. They got it.
But you know what's amazing to me is that I've talked about this book sort of ad nauseum for 2 years, actually 2 years in a week.
Yeah.
And nobody ever talks about that.
Isn't that funny?
Which is bizarre to me at first, because again, it meant so much. But yeah, I think sometimes we do sort of rush into substances to sort of prepare ourselves for something, situation we probably shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
And the substance doesn't, I mean, it didn't do me any good. It actually made my breath stink.
Right. You know, you're right about that too.
Right.
Yeah.
But that felt like healing at the time,
yeah.
And it wasn't, but
yeah.
It felt like it, yeah.
Well, that's really similar to my experience with drugs and alcohol, is I felt like I needed, it felt healing, but it wasn't, you know,
right.
It might have buffered me for a time from something that I didn't want to feel, but usually it's that pay now or pay later, and later is always worse. It was that kind of thing. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
What town in Mississippi did you grow up in?
I was born in Jackson. It's the capital of Mississippi.
Yeah.
And my grandmother lived by 45 minutes away in this sort of mostly black rural town called Forest. So okay. I just went between both of those.
Yeah, yeah. I love your grandmother. Is your grandmother still with us?
Yeah, she's 91. She's still alive.
That's amazing. She's one of my favorite characters in your book.
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, I felt comforted when you got to her house. I was like, oh, good.
You know, the hard part about that is that, you know, it's hard to write a book like that. But when you have a character like her, it's easy for people to create poles between her and my mom. Like, you know, I didn't think about it like this at all. But I definitely felt safeness at my grandmother's house. And there was a different kind of safeness I felt with my mother. But it was not at all like the robust kind of safeness I felt at my grandmama's house.
Yeah. Obviously, I want to talk about your mother because you wrote the entire book to her. And for me, it felt like I have two sons. They're 21 and 22, and we're really close. It felt like this head over heels love story from a son to his mom. That's what it felt like to me. That's what it read like.
Thank you for seeing it. Thank you for seeing that.
Yeah. I mean, she's obviously brilliant, almost beyond measure at sometimes several degrees, right? Held many impressive positions. And it's so clear how much you love her and you respect her and you revere her. But you also write about the beatings that she gave you in great detail. And you describe like starting as when you're a kid. And I felt like it kind of exposed our culture, black culture, but also Southern culture, because I know that Scott has experience with that and he's white, but he grew up in the South. And so it was quite hard to read.
Yeah.
It was hard to read and then regard your mother in the same way that you did. But your love was so, I mean, it just came through so hard. It was hard not to see her the way you did, too, at the same time. That adoration that you feel for her, that unconditional love. So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, I'm so, so just legitimately, sincerely thankful that you saw it as a love letter and that you saw it as an attempt to love and grasp like the complications of our relationship and like the complicated parts of my mom. Whenever I say this, I think people immediately go to Oedipus and Oedipal complex. And if you want to do that, that's fine. But, you know, my mama was 19 when she had me. It was just us until I was 17 and I left the house. And I was absolutely fascinated and in love, not just with my mom at the house, but like who she was in my city, what she did. But at the same time, you know, she was at times my best friend, and like best friends, you fight. But the thing about fighting with your best friend, if she's your mama, is that you're always going to lose because she can pull out that strap or she can tell you to go do something. And I cannot tell her to do anything. So I wanted people to understand that my mother is wonderful and brilliant, and wonderful, brilliant people sometimes harm people they love. And I did the same. I mean, I don't have children. I never beat my children. And if I had them, I wouldn't beat them. But I've definitely hurt people who I told myself I would never, ever hurt or harm. And I'm not saying it's the same thing because I don't know what it's like to have a child because I don't have a child. But I don't think what my mother did to me is that different than what people who love people do to people. I don't think we should harm people we love, but we all know people who love us are the people who often harm us the most. And often we harm the people we love the most. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't want to get sociological with it and do a mass overview. I wanted to sort of sit in that relationship and, you know, create enough portals of entry for people who had different relationships with their parents or with other people who they love. There's a really thin line between terror and intimacy.
Can you say that again?
I mean, there's a soup. I don't even know if there is a line, but I think there's a super thin line between terror and intimacy. And when you see your mother toe that line, sometimes unsuccessfully, it can, and you sort of bear the consequence of it, it can it can be really scary.
Yeah. Yeah. My mother was 19 when she had me too. My parents met at the University of Illinois, and I was born in Chicago. And actually, I want to just read something that your mother wrote after she read Heavy. This is the quote. "These are your memories, your renderings. I will not dispute them. What I know is that I should not have whipped you, or to use your favorite word, this is parenthetically, or to use your favorite word, beaten you. For those who are curious, no, I did not grow up with parents who beat their children. My father never laid a hand on me. My mama whipped me once or twice that I can remember. She whipped my brother Jimmy an awful lot," who's another great character in your book. And then Linda, my oldest sister, and Jimmy fought too much. And then, you know, she goes on from there. And because I was wondering if she was beaten a lot. My parents were both beaten a lot. My mother was just woefully abused with straps, with locking in the closet. She was beaten by the nuns at the Catholic school she went to, called it Black Savage. Like, she had a really, really, you know, just destructive. They almost killed her, but they didn't. Wow. And then she had me. And so, not as a result, I think of both of their childhoods, neither of them ever laid a hand on me. But I understand that. You know, I understand that type of violence because of the way they described it to me. And I understand how much is woven in the fabric of Black Americans. It was passed down and passed down and passed down. And even though it wasn't passed to your mother, it's still in our culture, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I don't think that people outside the culture understand it as well. Understand how it could be love as well, that's protection. You know, you beat somebody so they don't go out and get their ass beat by the police or get killed, right? Which is something that she did with you, right?
Yeah, and you know, the thing about my mom writing that is that, you know, she'll say in some way that it wasn't passed down, but then she'll say she watched my grandmama beat her only son.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, I'm not trying to question my mother's letter, but I think that the culture and the family did pass that down to her, even if grandmama and my grandfather, who I really never knew, didn't beat or pummel her. She saw a small woman beat a bigger Black boy for a lot of her young life. You know what I'm saying? So I think I'm not trying to say like that everyone who sees that is going to mimic it, but I think my mama had a model of how you raise Black boys.
Yes.
And I think she sort of imitated that model.
Well, I mean, that's one of the most powerful things we can do as parents. I mean, it may be the most powerful thing. What we say doesn't matter nearly as much as what we model. Mm. You know, that is what we learn. I learned how to parent from watching my mother do it, not from what she told me.
Right.
And so, I think that's extremely powerful, and it can't help but influence. So do you consider that you had a food addiction, if that's something you did?
At different times, I definitely did. I was definitely addicted to, I don't know, eating, what do they call it, binging, you know, eating way too much. And for me, it was always tied to freedom. So, you know, I never had a license. My mother wouldn't let me get a license. So I didn't have a car. So I would, in Mississippi, you know, it's a car culture. So you get around with cars. So I was friends with people who had cars. And one of the things I always thought was ill about having a car at 15, 16, 17 was that meant you could drive to the store and buy whatever food you wanted. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when my mama, she had a fellowship to do a postdoc at Harvard when I went to college at Millsaps. And she left me the car. I was supposed to go take the car home, even though I didn't have a license. And instead of taking the car home, I took it to Millsaps. But I felt so free, not just because I was driving without a license, but because I could drive to Waffle House. I could drive to Dunkin' Donuts. Do you know what I'm saying? So I think that car enabled me to do something that I think you see the beginnings of early in that book, was, you know, drinking the blue cheese, Justin. And then, you know, whenever I had lots of jobs. So whenever I make money, I would go to all you can eat places. I would go to Dunkin' Donuts and get 12 donuts. And then before you know it, you know, I went to college to write, but I also went to college to play basketball and football. And then, you know, I gained like 50 pounds.
Right.
So I definitely was addicted to food, but I was more so and more tragically addicted to starving. Like, that felt so good.
Yes. Yes. So I just wanted to juxtapose this. I'm going to quote you now. You're in college here. And you say, "An hour later, I walked back down to the kitchen, dug 6 of the 8 slices out of the garbage," you're talking about pizza, "ran warm water on them, picked off the pepperoni, and warmed up my second dinner. I didn't feel depressed. I didn't feel white. I felt so free. I felt fantastic." that was just like, I truly expected you to say that you warmed up your second dinner and you were lower than you'd ever been. Like, that's what I would, that's the next sentence in my head. And when you said you didn't feel depressed, what did you mean by you didn't feel white?
Oh, that's a great question. So, as you see in the book, like, I had only been to majority white schools maybe 2 years out of my 12 years of schooling. And so when I got to Millsaps College, not only am I in a college that's like 90%, 80%, 85% white or something like that, but, you know, the most important part was it was only like 4 or 5% black. So I go from having this very sort of adversarial relationship with whiteness in my state and in my city in terms of police officers and teachers to having to share a room with, you know, I'm sleeping in the bedroom with, you know, white first year students whose parents don't want them to be sleeping in the bedroom with a black boy. Going to classes with white teachers who think I'm plagiarizing because I'm using the word ambivalent. So I saw in a lot of my friends, one way that they dealt with this was to sort of whiten their mannerisms or change, you know, whiten their voices or, you know, there was a belief among some of those folks at my school. I understand that if you could whiten yourself, you could make it through that 4 years without a lot of those puncture wounds, you know? And so what I'm trying to say in that section is that I wasn't eating those white people's food to feel white or I didn't, and the scary part is I didn't feel depressed. The scary part is I was eating those pieces of pizza from that those white boys had thrown away.
Yeah.
And it felt so good, right? That's what I'm trying to show throughout the book is that, you know, we really have, I needed to interrogate pleasure because there was, that shouldn't have felt good, but it did. And then my boy came in, he saw me and he let me, he gave me some language. But before that, I was, I mean, that actually was a practice. I would go through the dorms on the regular looking for uneaten pizza that I could warm up. And
Wow. Thank you for that. Thank you for that explanation. I think I understood that while reading the book at the time, but when I pulled out that quote, I was just keyed in on that. And I understand that. That's another only one in the room, which you were quite a lot.
So often.
Yes. And in different ways. Definitely the only black boy, black man. But, you know, then you were the only one who was, what was your highest weight? What was your weight at the height?
You know, I just want to say again, thank you for asking incredible questions that nobody ever asked these questions. These are the kind of questions I thought I'd be asked when the book came out.
Oh, good.
I was a fullback in high school, so I weighed like 235.
Yeah.
I played power forward. I was like 6'2", 235 when I got to college. And I knew I had to lose weight because I was going to play football and basketball. I was going to try to get down under 200. But again, as I said, like because of a lot of things that I was experiencing, because of a lot of things I brought to college, I just ate and ate. So after that first semester, I got up to about close to 300. Second semester, I went way over 300, like 309, 319, something like that. So I was at my highest, I was probably like honestly between 319 and 330.
Wow. I was also really struck by like this brother's playing basketball. Like that's, you were, and you were good, right? Or you are good.
I mean, I'm definitely not good now. That my arthritic hips won't let you do much.
Yeah.
But I mean, I wasn't LeBron or anything like that, but you know, I could play, you know, people knew I could play ball, but you know, and when I transferred to Oberlin, you know, I played ball and I was okay. It's hard to say you're good when, you know, like, so many, I'm not gonna say I'm good at anything actually, but I could play ball. I got recruited to go to college to play basketball.
Well, that means you're good.
But I was so big, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I never knew. That's the thing about weight. It's like, I was just a big boy.
Yeah.
And I always thought I could get bigger, but I never imagined myself ever getting smaller. And I think that's one of the captivating things about weight loss is like, if you're a big person or you've been a big person your entire life, and what really happens to most people, regardless of age, is like, as you grow older, you get bigger.
Yeah.
So I can just only, I imagine myself sometimes getting, you know, more cut or more defined. But, you know, at 230, I never imagined myself at 200 or 150.
Right.
And when I got to 300, I never was like, oh, man, I wonder what will happen if I get back to 250. I was like, what the fuck? Am I about to get to 340? And at that, yeah, so.
You were like observing yourself just getting bigger.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just bigger, yeah. Bigger, and bigger.
And like, wow.
And then, but the mirror, you know what? I remember once I had my girlfriend came over to see me in my dorm around the same time. And this is the thing about love, right? Like, she looked at me like she loved me.
Yes.
So, and I thought, oh, if she looks at me that way, there's no way that I'm quote unquote gross. And I remember once when she left and I looked in the mirror, it was in front of me. And then again, I was sharing a room with this other kid. So his mirror was right behind and I saw my back in the mirror. And that was something I'd never seen. You know, you can see your head, your shoulders.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit. Okay. Like, you are not who you think you are, Kiese Layman. I remember that. So
what did you see when you saw your back?
I saw a back that was far bigger than I thought my back was.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I saw what they call love handles that I actually didn't think existed. I saw the back of my head, which wasn't fat or anything like that. It was just literally, I never literally had seen the back of my head.
Isn't interesting?
Yeah. And now I think, you know, with these cameras and everything, people see all sorts of parts of their bodies. But right. I mean, when I was young, my mother, you know, in a scene we talked about earlier, my mother called me fat. She mm-hmm. told me to get my fat ass out of the car. And so I always knew I was a fat, big kid, but I was also athletic. So it didn't, you know, it wasn't like I was getting punished for it. So I never felt like pejoratively fat. Like I just was like husky. But during that semester, I don't want to fat shame or be fat phobic either, but like I just became unhealthily big. Like it wasn't healthy. You know what I'm saying? It wasn't healthy for me. Yeah.
There's one scene, you're wearing your mom's jeans. And I was like, oh, okay. So the picture I have of him, he can't be that big because he's wearing his mom's jeans and she's not very big. So I was thinking that maybe you were seeing yourself differently at that time than you were.
I did. You know, I knew I was a husky kid. You know, you used to have to get the husky jeans back in the day.
Yeah.
And my mom, you know, and I knew my mama called me. I mean, I felt like I was husky and fat. But again, like, I don't know. I was like very, like mobility was crucial to me. But the thing is, my mom, this was in the 80s where there were, I don't remember what the name of these jeans were, but they were like women were wearing these really baggy kind of jeans, like super baggy, but they were cinched at the waist.
Yes.
And I wrote a whole scene about this because I used to like to wear my mama's, like she used to have these big old white shorts and I would put them on because they would be baggy and they'd be sagging. This is before everybody started wearing baggy shorts. But it made me feel like I was like Jordan because Jordan was just starting to wear like really baggy shorts.
Yeah.
And I would go outside and I'd play in her shorts and I'd get real sweaty and I'd come back and I'd take them off and she had another pair. It was just like him. I put them on and she reminded me of that like when I was writing this book.
Mm.
And I just don't know. I think there's something interesting about like wearing my mama's like clothes. Mm-hmm. And it was always clothes that really were kind of like gender neutral. You know what I'm saying? Like her jeans seemed actually to be a bit feminine masculine and I felt comfortable in that feminine masculine place. You know what I'm trying to say? So
yeah.
So in terms of I just know my weight all through. I wasn't like 300 or 400 pounds in high school or in junior high, but I was a big boy. You know what I'm saying? I was a big, but my mama had big clothes at the time and I felt comfortable wearing those.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, that scene struck me too. And I stopped there for a second because I was trying to picture my kids wearing my jeans.
Right.
maybe my younger one, maybe Justin at some point, but I don't think it would work.
But you know, part of it is because we had way more books than we had money. You know what I'm saying? Like I had one pair of jeans for school.
Yes.
And we didn't have a washer. So I would wash them out in the hand, I'd hang them up and dry them. Or stuff like that. So like if I had my own and my friends around time, people were wearing jabots, they'd be coming to school with jabots and stuff. And again, the only reason I could get away with my like suspect style was because I played sports. You know what I'm saying? Like because I was an athlete and because people thought I was funny. But I often think about what my life would have been like if I was the size I was and I didn't participate in basketball or football or tennis or track. And I wasn't like, you know, class clown. Like, I think I did those things partially to hang on, you know?
Well, they worked. They worked. It's, yeah. I mean, the people you hung with and how you, the esteem in which they held you came through in the book. And that was, you fall in love with you right away. So you're rooting for you the whole time. And to see that other people see you and love you is really helpful for the reader. Because you feel like with those people, you're safe. There's a few people in the book that seem to really understand who you are, or at least what you present at that time.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now I want to talk about losing weight because you mentioned it earlier. And you say to your Uncle Jimmy, right, when he asks about your dramatic weight loss, that you just, quote unquote, love losing weight. And you go to these great extremes. You're jogging for miles and miles. You sit in saunas, right? You're like barely eating. And you even injured yourself, which that scene, I had to read it twice because I was like, what did he do to himself? Tell me about that. Why did it feel so good?
That question is, I mean, I think the only honest answer to that question is the book. But if I'm going to try to be clear and short, is that I think for some of us, I mean, addiction, I think alcohol and drug and food addiction are sort of tied in that sometimes we want to not remember. And I think sometimes when you don't remember, you also want to not exist, right? We don't want yesterday to overwhelm us. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I just did not, honestly, I wanted to be in control of my disappearance. Like my body breaking is what saved my life, because if my body did not break, there is no way in hell I would be alive today, because the number could not get low enough. Like the joy I felt from seeing that number go from 319 to 289 to 250 to 230 to 214. And then when you finally get below 200, I mean, it doesn't matter how you got there. If you've been way over 200, you just literally feel like this is the best feeling in the world, better than love, better than sex, better than drugs, better than gambling, anything. Yeah. And then when I got to 200, I was like, well, yo, shit, can I get down to 175? I can't even imagine that. Mm. And then you get down to 175 and you're like, well, wait a minute. Is 150 possible? And then, you know, like nothing in my mind told me to stop and say, well, Kiese, you haven't been 150 pounds since like third grade.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And in third grade, I'm like 4 feet something. You know what I mean? And now I'm 6'2". And then I have this thing to check my body weight. And I'm weighing myself literally like 30 times a day. And, you know, trying to, if it's a little off, I want to go and sweat. And so anyway, my point is that when I say I love losing weight, it's true. But I mean, one of the things I'm trying to say in heavy is that we have to interrogate those things we say we love, whether they're a partner, eating practice, or a nation. Mm-hmm. And I did. I loved trying to disappear. I loved the control. I loved being out there running until my knees and my joints and my back just wanted to break. And then I loved giving myself as little water or food as possible and trying to do it again. And I think it just had everything to do ultimately with wanting to harm myself, but also just wanting to be in complete control when I just had not been in a lot of control for most of my life.
Do you think that what you were experiencing with losing weight was similar to what your mother experienced with gambling?
Yes. I'm acting like I'm thinking about the answer to that, but I know the answer to that. You know what I mean? Like, this is not particular to my mother because I started to experience it, but when you get to that place where there's no question what, you know, if you earn, you know, like I was earning money, like, you know, I don't come from money. I don't come from wealth, but I come from people who know how to make, you know, we're always going to be hustling to make a dollar. We're always going to, but when you're someone who understands that every dollar you make is going into a machine or going over a blackjack table, You're trying to disappear. Like you're telling yourself that the labor that you did to earn whatever you have isn't worth anything. Or what I would tell myself when I started gambling was, I worked hard for this. I've spent my whole life not being like reckless with money, so I deserve it.
Yes.
You know, like I deserve to give my money, give my hard earned labor to a machine. Let me kill myself. Let me kill my economic future because I deserve it. Like that's what I think my mama was saying, though she never said it. I know that's what I was saying when I started gambling.
Isn't that interesting? And so then the obsession takes over, right? There's one more. Yes. There's one more goal you can hit with weight loss. There's one more payout you can get. You talked about like people like stalking the machines in the casino and then hitting, you know, like that kind of thing. And I understand that obsession too. And I haven't had it with gambling. I really hate losing money. So
yeah, good.
I haven't gotten there yet, but I completely understand it. And I understand that obsession to keep going despite negative consequences, because there's that mirage, that illusion that there's a landing place where it's going to feel like it should feel, you know?
And they reward you. Like, this is the thing I think people who haven't been deep in gambling addiction don't understand, is that like these casinos, you know, when you come in, you're like, they give you some sort of like yellow card. And if you lose a little, if you lose like, you know, $10,000, you get a red card. And if you lose, let's say $50,000, you know, you might get this brown card. But if you lose $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000, you get to be a VIP. You know what I'm saying? Like you get, they're rewarding you for literally losing. And I remember telling my partner, I was like, can you believe I made it to Sachem? Cause that was the highest designation you could make it to as a, at the casino I went to. And that literally means you lost the most money.
Wow.
You know, so you're I'm walking around feeling like my credit is fucked. I sold my, you know, I gambled away my car. I mean, I would have gambled away my home, but I lived for free in a dorm on the campus of Vassar College. But like, I'm bragging because this casino is giving me a badge that says, this motherfucker is dumb as fuck. He gave us all his motherfucking money and we're going to give him a card for it. And I, and like, I was, that was the proudest, that was the proudest card I had in my wallet.
Right. It's like a gambling diploma you get, huh?
It was, fam. And I was like PhD level,
right?
You know? And which meant, and what does it mean? It means that you can bring more people to this hideous place to sleep for free while they lose money and attempt to become a PhD. Cause that's what it all, that's what it really means. You could, you know, I went to every concert in the world, I ate all these free, quote unquote, free meals. You know, I slept in like these hotel rooms, but you know, you buying a t-shirt that literally probably cost you like $3,000.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Like you're buying a meal for your family using your points.
Yeah.
And that meal was like a $15,000 meal, even though it says it's like $200 or $300 because of the way it works. So anyway, I just think it is, Todd. I hadn't thought about this before, but I, yeah, like that place was incentivizing.
Yes.
Like destruction of your future. That's what it does.
Isn't that amazing? And so many people buy in. Because of that promise, and it's feels like easy money or, you know, whatever it is, it feels like you're getting something, like you said, that I'm entitled to come and do this. I'm entitled to spend my hard earned money this way, especially because you didn't have money growing up and you hadn't been frivolous with it. And then that entitlement leads to being ripe to buy into those incentives. And then the obsession kicks in and then that's all they need.
Yeah,
I'm going to switch gears because Scotty just gave me a sign that we're running out of time.
And it's not my fault.
It is your fault. No. So your memoir is about so many different things, but race is it's a through line throughout the whole book. And I want to know so many things that I don't have time to ask everything I want to know. But in Terrors, you talk about you're a professor at Vassar, which is where you are when you're talking about gambling. You're going back and forth to Vassar where you're a professor. And you talk about what it means to be black versus brown post 9/11, which I thought was really interesting. Just your observations leaving Poughkeepsie, going to Manhattan to be a part of the rescue and the cleanup after 9/11 and seeing brown people who were then looked at differently for the first time, looked at as possible terrorists. And you describe them being just like the American flag threw up on them, right? It's like everything is covered with the American flag so they can show that they're proud to be American. With everything that's happened this year, I'm jumping now because I still want to talk about race, but with everything that's happened this year, which for us black folks isn't new stuff, but it feels like the world woke up this year to what's been happening to us for centuries. And I have a friend, Jay Connor. He's a friend of Scott and mine's, and he's a podcaster. He's a podcast called The Extraordinary Negroes. So shout out to Jay. So we were on a panel together.
Oh, I know Jay.
You know, Jay. Okay.
Yeah.
So
I think he used to do that with Alex Hardy.
Yes.
I think they used to do,
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So he says, someone asked on the panel about educating white people about what they need to do for black people right now. And Jay responded, he says, you know, we're exhausted. Black folks are too busy auditioning for our humanity. We cannot educate you. And in that article, you talked about the way that black people have to perform. And you talked about your grandmother performing in the chicken plant, right? You in the classroom, your mom in the grocery store. Can you talk about that at all?
I think at the root of a lot of that performance is this expectation from black people and black bodies, as people say, that we are going to be thankful and or patriotic in spite of how we've been treated, right? Like, you have to lead with the patriotism. You have to, like, you know, you have to lead with the thankfulness in order to make a critique or to order really to get out of the store. And that's what I saw with, like, the Muslim and Arab, quote unquote, looking people on that train, right? Like, they were like, okay, it's post 9/11. Everyone is going to be thinking that we are trying to terrorize them. So let us, you know, foreground our patriotism, our love of country. And so for my mom and my grandma, I'm not saying it's the same thing at all, but I've seen my grandmother, who is just voluminous, thick woman, make herself so tiny to get out of public spaces with white people where they're challenging her. You know, I've seen my mother do the opposite, which is to employ a very, like, I'm much smarter than you kind of, like, stance when dealing with white people, when it's sort of not needed. Like, you know, if you're smarter than somebody, you don't need to perform it. You don't need to let them know, you know what I'm saying? And so I just saying that I've seen what I think white supremacy in Mississippi and New York and in the nation can do to our bodies, just in terms of shrinkage, or sometimes making yourself seem like you're so, like, a giant because you're scared of what these people will do.
Yes.
And I just didn't want to do either of those things. Like, I don't need to let people know how many degrees I have or talk down to anybody, white person, who's serving me. And I definitely don't need to make myself small or act like I'm the biggest patriot in the world to have a critique of this country. Though I understand why some people have had to do that. I think my challenge is to not, is to attempt to interrogate that and talk about, like, why some people feel the need, you know, to make themselves larger than life or, like, tinier than life to make it home. You know, yeah. And that's really what it's about. It's about, like, how do you make it home with dignity? And it's just hard. It's hard for everybody in this country. I think it's really hard for Black Americans across the world in this country, and especially in a place like Mississippi, because they demand that you be thankful. Mm-hmm. They you know, when they should be thankful that we haven't retaliated. You know what I'm saying? Like, their demand is that we be thankful. And I'm not, you know, my grandmother is, like, the incredible, most incredible human being in the world. She worked in a chicken plant. She worked in white people's homes. Why in the world should she be thankful that you paid her pennies? Why should she be thankful that she never retaliated against what y'all did to her because she was a Black woman who grew up in 1929? But it's inverted. So we have to prove our thanks to these folks who never, ever have to prove their thanks or allegiance to us. And I just don't want to live that way.
Ah, wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. That wasn't exactly what I was hoping you'd say, because I didn't know you were going to say any of that. But it satiates me, and it articulates something I've been feeling for a really long time in a way that I hadn't been able to articulate it.
Thank you.
So thank you
for this conversation.
Yeah, seriously, man.
I'm so thankful.
Ooh. Okay. So you are the Herbert H. McAlexander Chair of English at the University of Mississippi, right?
Yes.
And you are the recipient of the 2021 Radcliffe Fellowship at Harvard, which is very cool. What else is on the horizon for you, KSA?
Well, my first essay collection, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, just got reissued. It just came out yesterday.
Congratulations. That's nice.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I got a new novel coming out. I have a new sort of multi-genre book coming out. I got a children's book coming out.
Oh,
so
you've been busy.
They're making a film of Heavy. So
they are.
Issa Rae bought it. And
Of course. Yeah. Oh, that's so smart. Congratulations on that, too. I'm so excited. I hope they do your book justice.
I do too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
I think they will, though. I think they will. And even if they don't, you know, it's like, they're going to do it justice, but it's an adaptation. I want them to be free to do what they want with it. But
yeah.
I mean, I hope it keeps some of the integrity.
Yeah. Oh, wait, really quick. You posted something yesterday about getting your rights back.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I you know, because of all of the book stuff that happened with me, I had to end up, I was with Penguin Putnam, and then the editors asked me to take the racial politics out of the book. So I ended up giving them all of their money back, and I went independent, just like what my friend Jesmyn Ward did. And I sold How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America in Long Division. I sold How to Slowly for $1,000. I sold Long Division for like $4,000. And, you know, we made that person a lot of money. And then, you know, I tried to get the book back a few years ago, and they wouldn't let me. So this year, after, you know, I finally got my money up and I was able to buy my book back, but I had to buy it back for like 10 times what the guy bought it for after he'd already made a ton of money. And so I reissued How to Slowly Kill Yourself. A Long Division will be coming out in August too, reissued. But, you know, but one of the things that, this awakening has just done for me is let me know that, like, my life is finite. And if I'm going to be gone tomorrow, I just want the art that I've created to have integrity to be in the world. And, you know, I signed a terrible deal with that first guy. And I just wanted to have the book in the world the way I wanted it to be. You know, I wanted to add some more essays, take some essays out. But much more importantly, I wanted to own the rights to all of those essays. And now I do. And I didn't before.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's fantastic. And so what you're saying is this reissue copy, the money will not be going to the place that issued it in the first place. I'll be purchasing that reissued copy then.
Thank you. I hope you do.
Yeah. Tell me where people can find you, KSA.
You can find me on the Google. You can find me on Twitter. I think KSA Lehman is my Twitter handle. I'm on Instagram, KSA Lehman.
Mm-hmm.
But mainly, I think if you really want to know me, you can just, you know, get heavy anywhere. You can get How to Solo Cure Yourself and Others anywhere. And or you can just read a lot of essays and different kinds of art I've created on the internet for free. So I'm pretty much anywhere on your computer if you just type my name in there.
That's how I found you. That's exactly what I did. I went right to your site and then to Instagram. And you are a stand-up guy. You hit me back. I'm so thrilled that you came on and did this. Thank you so, so much.
Yeah, thanks, KSA. Yo,
thank you, Laura, for asking questions that actually I care about and that nobody's asked before. And thank you so much, Scott, for helping this work. And thank y'all.
Thank you.
Hey, great episode, honey. And now I want to welcome all of our new Patreon members.
Yes, welcome. And I still get a lot of people who don't really understand what Patreon is.
All right, well, break it down for them.
Thank you. I will. I'll break it down quickly, though. When you join our Patreon, you get all kinds of access and bonus content and special opportunities. And your monthly fee, which is small, helps us to keep bringing you all these incredible stories like the one you just heard.
Right on. We hope you're all enjoying the monthly storytelling video series that we're releasing and our Zoom hangs. Please come hang with us. Yeah. Monthly membership start at just $5.
Per month? Like, what costs $5 a month anymore?
Nothing. Right? And you get all of this, and you're helping support us. So, and while we love seeing you all in our Zoom hangs, we're going to be trying something new, a new way to connect over the next few months. It's called Voxing.
I love myself a good Vox.
Uh-huh.
But that's V-O-X, right? Not B-O-X.
You got it. Voxing.
Yes. Uh-huh. V is in victory. That's a great idea, hon.
Right on. Thank you, honey. And so which of our patrons are we shouting out today?
Well, first up is Mercedes Cusick, LMFT.
Right on. Right. Mercedes. Yep.
She's a licensed trauma therapist and is a certified EMDR therapist. And this means that Mercedes has had advanced training in complex and developmental trauma. So don't tune out. I'm going to tell you what that means.
Mm-hmm. This is some pretty advanced stuff.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
She's doing something really special. It's called EMDR Intensives. And EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. So simply by stimulating both sides of the brain, it helps heal the brain and desensitizes traumatic or upsetting memories. I did EMDR when I was dealing with some childhood trauma. And let me tell you, I was actually stunned by the results.
Oh, wow. Thank you for all that, honey. This is something that everyone can benefit from. Maybe like Laura, you've experienced a disturbing or traumatic event in your life. It could be a car accident, work-related events, sexual assault, crime-related traumas, traumatic medical procedures. Maybe you've had a severe injury, childhood bullying, military combat, or emotional abuse.
Yeah, and if you've experienced any of those things, but like so many busy people, you just don't have time for traditional EMDR, then Mercedes' individualized concierge curated program is for you. The intensive range from half a day to several days, but they're the equivalent of, get this, 2 to 6 months of weekly therapy.
Wow, that's incredible. I feel really lucky that we get to promote this.
Yeah, me too.
I also want to add that because I think it's important that there is no need to talk extensively about these disturbing experiences. And because the intensive format decreases treatment time, it also saves you a considerable amount of money in the long run.
Yeah, that's facts right there. So if you want to start feeling better now, and what do I always say? Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you?
Then EMDR intensives are the way to go. And California residents, click the link in our show notes and find find the link to Mercedes Cusick's website and book your EMDR intensive today. That's Mercedes Cusick, LMFT, licensed trauma therapist. She's located in Woodland Hills, California. See our show notes for the website. But you, I just want to also say you can do this virtually if you're in the state of California. You don't have to go to her offices in Woodland Hills. So any California resident, click on that website and go see Mercedes.
All right. That's www.mercedescusick.com.
Thanks, hon.
You're welcome. Honey, so what's new with How to Do the Pot podcast?
I'm glad you asked, because it's Ellen Scanlon, and we love Ellen.
We do love Ellen.
She's one of our favorite previous guests. Yep. And as you know, she has the How to Do the Pot podcast, which is such a great name.
It is.
Right? And it's all about demystifying cannabis for women. Recently, they released their new Sleep 101 series. Every woman I know could use this. In these short episodes, real women share how cannabis helps women fall asleep, stay asleep, and not wake up with a weed hangover.
Right. And weed is something I feel so many people have old ideas about.
Right. Totally. I mean, we're not talking about the shoebox full of seeds and stems that your uncle had under his bed. On regular episodes of the How to Do the Pot podcast, every week you can listen to fun, short episodes that answer all the questions that women secretly Google about cannabis. How to Do the Pot shares women's personal stories and advice from experts to help with solutions around stress, sleep, sex, and chronic pain, with the goal of helping women feel more confident about their choices about cannabis.
How enlightening.
Right? Mm-hmm. And if you're ready for practical advice about weed for women, by women, listen to How to Do the Pot wherever you get your podcasts.
Right on. Hey, next up is Cute Booty Lounge.
Yay!
Yeah, Cute Booty's a concept born in Kelly's garage in 2004. She was looking to make pants that embrace a woman's curves.
Yes.
Particularly what?
The booty.
Right on.
Yes.
But that was the pants that were still polished enough to wear out and about. Her, mm-hmm. her signature is her patented scrunch booty pockets.
Yep.
Cute Booty Lounge is made by women and for women right here in the USA. The company is incredible, female and minority owned. Go to cutebooty.com in our show notes and order yours today. And honey, what do people always say when you're wearing those leggings?
Cute booty.
Very cool. Right on. And we want to continue to shout out Kathleen Hahn.
Kathleen.
Yep. She is one of the ones that is really just supporting the show every month.
OG.
Yep.
And from the beginning.
Honey, I talk to her every now and then, and she is listening to the shows.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a lot out of it. She's a super fan.
She's a super fan.
Yep. And she has a lot of adventures in front of her. And I hope I get permission to tell everybody what she's up to at some point.
Well, maybe she can tell everybody when she joins our Zoom hang next month.
Yeah, bring it on, Kathleen Hahn. Yeah.
And then, honey, we have Brent Shaw.
I know. This is so cool.
Right. So, Brent, if you follow us on Instagram, you've seen Brent's work. He manages our Instagram for The Only One
and
in the Room.
And he does a fantastic job at it.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. We're about to hit. What about it? 40?
We're close to 40,000.
Damn.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable.
But Brent started his own podcast called the Student Performance Podcast.
Right on.
Performance Podcast. Did I say that right?
The Student Performance Podcast.
Right.
Yep.
And tell them what it is. Huh?
Well, in these episodes, Brent likes to dive deep into the science of concepts that people may never have known about that would have an impact on your well-being as a student.
Yes.
Things like exercise, meditation, sleep, nutrition, cold exposure, all of which will not only transform your life in the classroom, but help you live a more fulfilled life outside of it as well.
That's dope. And, you know, everybody should be a student of some kind, right? If
yeah.
you're a student of life or a student in the classroom. I don't know about that cold exposure thing, Brent. We're going to have to listen and talk about that.
A little research on that. Laura's not big into the cold.
I'm not big into the cold, but we appreciate you and wish you all the luck with this podcast.
It's called the Student Performance Podcast.
It'll be in our show notes. And thank you guys for listening all the way to the end. Thank you so much for listening. The Only One in the Room is produced by the creative genius that is Scott Slaughter and edited by the uber-talented polymath Christina Barcy and her team at Avon House Productions. Hey, you're still listening? Good. Please subscribe right now while you're thinking about it, quick, before you forget. And be sure to like and leave us a review of the show. Want to connect with some other Only One listeners? Be sure to join our private Only One in the Room Facebook group or check out Patreon on our website for exclusive content that you won't find anywhere else. And do you have an Only One in the Room story that you'd like to share? Please send it to theonlyonepod kiasmusic@gmail.com.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.